Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
There's a small town in the mountains.
Isn't that where all these tests are?
Midterms technically in the middle. We're getting two tests. So
you get tests all the time, though. That's what happens.
It's the term, so I'm right.
You're in the midst of it. It's a midterm. Yes. Yes, your midterm. There's a test coming up on Wednesday. I haven't made it up yet, so I don't have any questions, but probably 35, maybe 40, something like that. More on intelligence than the other topics, just because we spent more time on intelligence. And there's just more material there. A little less on cognition and language and a little less on motivation. But that's the plan. So that's Wednesday. As far as studying goes, I would suggest, as I said last term, read. When you take a look at the book, look at the headings and sort of subheadings, anything bolded, things like that. If you can describe to yourself what those things are about. Same thing with the PowerPoint slides. If you see PowerPoint slide and you say, okay, Kinsey report, odd interviewing techniques. Oh, right, it was open-ended interviews. Lousy sample, oh, right, it was mostly university students and, you know, a preponderance of them did just come back from World War II. Got in trouble with volume of females. Oh, right, because he said all that stuff about males, and you can then think about all the data I told you about. But the female one got him in trouble because, of course, it was 1948. So if you can do that, put it in your own words, it's really going to help you.
Last year, tend to use terminology from the books rather than what we used in class.
Yeah, I guess it probably does to a point. I mean, I think I make up about half those questions; the other half I get on a disc.
So we really want to focus on using the definitions in the book.
It's hard to say, really. I mean, it's more a question of sort of knowing them both and being able to put both sets of material together. The book is background reading for the most part. What I think is important is what I hit up here in class. It's not just what I think is important. It's also, frankly, to be completely honest with you, it's what I find interesting. Because I don't want to bore myself. So I pick things that I think are important and then little things that I think are interesting. But I think if you can relate the two together, and that's why if you can, like I said, if you can talk about something and put it into your own words, you're going to be in pretty good shape, I think. So sort of talk to yourself. You look like an idiot doing it, but it really helps you in your studying technique. And I hope you're already studying, because you shouldn't just study the night before a test. It's a bad idea. It can work, but it works less and less as you go further and further into university. Yes, I know it worked in grade 12. You know. Not studying at all worked just fine for me, mostly, in high school. Yeah, I found out pretty quickly in university it didn't work at all. First paper, we had to write papers in intro psych when I was at UF, at Western for my undergrad. And the first paper I wrote, I got a 58. So, you know, it's a big wake-up call. Most of you have had the wake-up call already from the first term. So look stuff over. Of course, I'll be online on Tuesday night. Well, I'll be online tonight. I'm always, you know, during the week. So if you have any questions, you can always ask me. No problem. Of course, also, you can listen to the lectures if that's something you find interesting. So, we'll finish up talking about motivation today. I don't think we'll go any further than that. You've got a test coming up and stuff, so there's no reason to, it seems to me, cloud your mind with new facts that won't be tested until March. Okay? By the way, welcome to February. Weird, eh? Doesn't it feel like it was just September?
Winter just started.
Yeah. Yeah, so. Amazing. Tomorrow, of course, is the Groundhog Day.
So
I encourage you to watch that movie. There. Great movie, Bill, with Bill Murray. All right. So we talked a bit about Kinsey. I talked about, as I mentioned before, the odd interviewing techniques. Basically, it's because it was an open-ended thing. He really wasn't a social scientist. He certainly learned how to do it eventually. There's no doubt about that. And the Kinsey Institute's still really important. The sample wasn't very good, as I mentioned, because it's a pretty biased sample. You don't worry much about biased samples because you might be thinking, oh, I'm volunteering for those intro psych things, those experiments, and This is also a lousy sample. You guys aren't representative of the population of the humans. Really, you know, you're more educated, you got more money than most humans, etc. I know it may not feel like that, but think about it. There are 6.5 billion people on the planet. That said, most of those things are about how does something affect some fundamental human trait. This is trying to figure out how people think in the world. So in that case, you need a good sample, just like you need a good one when you're doing, say, an election poll. Okay? So the sample wasn't very good. And finally, as I mentioned again, the idea was that, you know, everybody knew men had sex, but women were asexual beings, apparently. And even if people didn't think they were, it was still, you know, what's the word I'm looking for? Unseemly to talk about women having sex. So, but it got things going, the Kinsey reports. It's important for a number of reasons. Kinsey was, his methods were suspect and all that stuff, but it's way better than the junk that's in, like, magazines. You know, like, every issue, you ever stand at the checkout and you're looking and there's Cosmopolitan and it's, you know, what men really want? What women? No, they don't. They don't. Somebody makes that crap up. There were surveys. There are attempts to do surveys by, and there have been a number of times, where they send out mailings. They send out sort of like surveys, and then they expect people that buy certain magazines to send them back in. Problem there is, buy a sample again. Who's going to fill them out? The people that are interested in filling them out. They're going to be different than people that don't fill stuff out. And today, for the first time ever, it's too cold in here. Let's try 1 degree Fahrenheit here. The Height Report was a sex report that came out in the early 1970s that was just, again, a big piece of junk. So if you hear about it ever, don't get too concerned about it. That was the person's name, Height, H-I-T-E. Again, lousy methods, not really knowing what... these are people that don't know what they're doing. Now, here's some interesting surveys. I believe these are actually Canadian data. 91% of people have been faithful to their partner. In other words, 91% of people haven't cheated on the person they're with right now. Ever. That's nice. Gives me some hope for the humans. 98% of them have been faithful in the last year. So that means that, you know, maybe they weren't before. That's why the number's a little higher. But now they are. So that's kind of a nice thing to hear, that people aren't, you know, cheating on their partners. That's good, seems to me. It's probably good for everybody. I'd be interested to see, this is data from about six, seven years ago. I would be interested to know how this has changed, what with the advent of the webcams and the internets. No, I'm serious, because I think it makes it a little more likely. Right. So psychologically, we've talked a bit about it, but physiologically. So you thought Kinsey was controversial in the 1940s, Masters and Johnson, 1966. Okay. This was a little more, in some respects, more controversial than you think. 60s? Well, 1966 is really still the 50s. That's a joke, apparently, just for me. Things are changing, etc. It's the mid-60s, but Not as much as this. Masters and Johnson, they kind of had people come in and they watched them have sex. They paid them, too. You know, there's studies, they paid them. Mostly medical students. Wow.
That's an interesting job.
It's a job, anyway. It's good work if you can get it.
Did they just watch straight up vanilla sex, or did they watch...
all kinds of stuff. Yeah. They basically, for the most part, they said to people, go have sex, we're going to watch it. And in another room, behind like one of them, you know, with the mirrors, you know.
Ignore the giant one-way mirror.
Yeah, that's right. Please go about your business and have sex. But mostly they were told, just have a good time. They weren't really interested in variety of, like Kinsey about the behavior. They were interested more in what was happening to people physiologically that you could actually see. They came up with what they called a sexual response cycle. First is, quote, excitement, which involves blood rushing to nether regions, pupils dilating. Then there's plateau, which is sort of the peak of excitement. Okay. Of course, then there's orgasm, the reason people have sex. No, it's just a joke. It's all about love and intimacy. And then there's resolution. I love that one. Oh, well, I guess that's when you smoke. Right? Now, with man, of course, once they've had step three, they can't go back to step one for a while. Women, of course, can go to orgasm plateau, orgasm plateau, orgasm plateau. They can. They don't have to. People shouldn't feel bad if they don't.
Sometimes I heard they get to three.
Indeed. Yeah, I've heard people say, I hear that's a myth. But the point here is that men are physiologically incapable, once they've ejaculated, of getting an erection for a while. And that while can range from a couple of minutes when you're younger up to like when you're like 80, a week. You know, a few days.
That works in contrary to what we heard about behavior in terms of sex. Mm-hmm. That men should have as much sex as possible, or if women...
Oh, no, it doesn't... You mean like sort of evolutionarily the best strategy. Mm-hmm. It does insofar as the fact that physiologically it's impossible to ejaculate again for a while. Right? Because you can't have an orgasm, well, you can't get an erection. Whereas it doesn't mean you can't go have more sex in a little, quote, little while. Or you could also, for example, go have sex with different people. Right? And this is true of anything that works the way we do. Any mammal, basically. Right? It's different with, say, chickens, you know, birds, things like that. But the physiological investment that a man puts into sex is a pretty big investment, because you got to realize there's not only do you have all the fun, you're also expending a lot of energy, if you're doing it right anyway. Nothing? No? None. Some of these are jokes, guys. But yeah, there's actually quite a bit of physiological effort, and you're actually, you know, there's stuff coming out of you. Right? You got to realize 300 million sperm, that's probably a little high. Probably between 150 and 200 million sperm in the ejaculate of most guys. One egg from a woman. Now, the egg's big, but just one. Big physiological investment there. So they actually figured this out by watching people. I guess they couldn't just figure this out on their own. So the refractory period is what happens, always happens in guys. Then that's that, I can't go back here for a while because I just got to lie here because I can't get an erection. And no, I don't want to cuddle. Nothing. No one's laughing at anything. Some of these are jokes. I'm not a misogynist pig. Well, I might be, but I'm still kidding around. Women can go through that too, of course. Right? But they don't have to. They can go back and forth. You see, and the point that I'm sort of making here, Jeff, is you actually have to go, you have to make more. You got to make more sperm. You got to make more semen. That takes some time. All right. The plateau, by the way, isn't just, like I said, it's not just like genital arousal. It's also things like your chest getting all like red. You know, like blood rushing there. It's your eyes, pupils dilating, heart beating faster, all that stuff. All right. By the way, when you look at Masters and Johnson, you would never expect there'd be people that paid people to have sex and they watched them. You know, he was an old guy with a bow tie. Just didn't look right. You would have thought it was some kind of crazy hippie or something. No, he was just a He's a doctor, and his wife was a nurse. There are some questions about now, you know, is it all completely that, these different phases like that, is it quite that, what's the word I'm looking for? Are they divided up completely, like, so cut and dried into those different categories? It, probably not quite as cut and dried as they said. Like anything like that when categories are made up. All right, hormonal effects. Women have more sex drive when they're ovulating than when they're not ovulating. This is correlated with estrogen levels. It's you got to realize though that estrogen and estradiol are pretty similar, in fact, to testosterone, and they still do it still affects your women's sex drive, which makes a whole lot of evolutionary sense, right? Because when are you going to be more likely to conceive a child? When you're ovulating. There's some really the interesting thing here is that most women don't know when they're ovulating. Some do, some can feel it, but most don't. Most women have no idea. But there's some really interesting data here, and it's kind of bizarre data collected from strippers. I'm dead serious. Strippers that are ovulating get bigger tips. Now, as odd as that sounds, because like strippers aren't trying to get pregnant, I don't think. I don't think that's the point of taking your clothes off and dancing around on a pole, right? That's not why they're doing that. But it makes you think, and the guys aren't trying to get the strippers pregnant. In fact, you know, it's probably, you try to, no. No, you're not supposed to do that, right? However, men for some reason find them more attractive, if we're defining that by how much money they're giving them as like tips. And one can assume then that there's something men are detecting, and it could be that the females are more, quote, they're just more attractive for some reason. And it could be pheromones. There's all kinds of it. Could be behavioral. It's probably all those things. Who knows? The interesting point here is that we have something. We got to realize that evolutionarily sex is for making babies. It's not just recreation. Right? So there's something interesting going on there. I don't really know what it is. But like I said, most women don't know that they're ovulating. Most women don't know they're ovulating. Some do, but most don't. It's interesting, in fact, that humans hide their ovulation, right? Women, it's every other mammal, you know when the female is ovulating or when she's able to have it to conceive because they go into heat, don't they? Humans don't.
Theory that it was because then the males take care of them the whole time instead of just right around.
That's in fact one of the theories. Why has this evolved? Because it's a strange thing to have evolved. One of them is that it's a way to trick males into staying around. Right? It's also conceivably a way for women to trick themselves into perhaps having a child. And you think, what do you mean? Well, think about it. We're pretty smart. Right? Unlike every other mammal, we're probably the smartest ones. We can say that pretty clearly. Having a child hurts. It's the most pain a human can go through, which explains why women have higher pain thresholds than men. So it hurts like hell. Part of the reason for that is we stood up, right? So it's a little harder to go through because of the way our pelvis works now, because of us standing up. It's having a... Having a baby is a lot harder than it is for, say, even our closest relatives, a chimp. So it's painful. It leads to a long period of taking care of a kid, which, again, is a big investment. Maybe if women had one kid, they'd never have another one. Right? This is another theory. We don't really know why. But those are both pretty good guesses. It's probably a bit of both, I would guess. So women are trying to fool men and also fool themselves. Evolutionarily, they aren't really trying to. Right? I think it's good for society that women don't go into heat. I'm just saying. No, it probably is. It's probably good for society in general. I don't think that's not why it evolutionarily happened, but I have these really weird sort of science fiction thinking moments, and I think, no, that wouldn't be good. But the hormones, of course, do affect your sex drive. Men have a lot less cycling in their sex drive than women do. But testosterone leads to arousal, and arousal leads to testosterone. Men produce more testosterone when they're sexually aroused, but also just giving them testosterone will sexually arouse them. But again, you see, men are fertile all month. Women are fertile really a couple of days a month. Is it possible for them to get pregnant? I know in high school and in elementary school when you had sex education, they told you that you can get pregnant by looking at a pee-pee. But it doesn't work that way. And you're not, the chance of you having a child all the way through the month is exceedingly slim. It's possible, but exceedingly slim. I think they told you that because they just thought it's probably easier to say that. And it is possible, right? But it's unlikely. Men, on the other hand, are fertile all the time, from the time they're 12 till they die. Which somehow explains a great deal about men, I think. Okay, psychology of sex. Unlike hunger or thirst, there's really no need per se to have sex. You can live without it. You can't live without water, you can't live without food, you can't live without air. You can live without sex. Your life sucks, but you can live without sex. Again, kidding. Come on. So there is a sort of physiological need there. Clearly, it's a physiological system, but it's not like we have to do it or we die. External stimuli are important in sort of psychologically in sexuality. Some data suggest more for men than women. It's easier for men to get aroused by, for example, quote, erotica than women. It's interesting, though, both males and females have the most physiological reaction, the most arousal to literally explicit depictions of sex, like porn, which, of course, is what the internet is for. So while people don't think that, you know, there's this whole notion out there that only men would like that, it's actually not true. But when men do get more aroused by it than women do. So question about porn, of course, does it lead to impossible expectations? It might. I think if, you know, you learn everything you ever learn about sexuality from some website, pick the one you want, it might lead to impossible expectations. You got to realize even these low-budget internet things are still films, basically, videos, whatever. There's editing involved. So there's a concern that it would lead to all kinds of impossible expectations. Of yourself and any partner. Imagine stimuli are important, so that's fantasy life. Totally normal. Pretty much everybody has sexual fantasies. Shouldn't bother you. You should have them at the appropriate time, it seems to me. I'm not talking about dreams here, though. Like, sex dreams, you know, you get genital arousal when you're having a sex dream or a dream about cookies or flying cookies. Right, doesn't matter, flying sex cookies, I don't know. Which in a dream would almost be sensible. Oh, they're flying sex cookies. Oh, I understand. Dreams are weird that way. So it isn't just about sex dreams when you have genital arousal. That's normal. It's supposed to happen. Knowing those why, it just does. People do have sex dreams. And of course, fantasies are much more, we talk about imagined stimuli. There is a sort of disorder. It's not, it's being starting to be recognized as a disorder. It's not officially recognized by the APA. But this idea of sexsomnia, they call it, which is that people, it's kind of like sleepwalking, except it's sleep sex. I'll say this, that at first it sounds like, well, that's pretty harmless. It's harmless until you realize that people have been charged with all kinds of, well, they might do something they're not supposed to do. You know, like with their kids or something. No, I'm serious. You're asleep. You don't know. So there's been cases like that. And it's completely, it's not like this person's doing this on purpose. And when they find out, they get all, I got to go to a doctor and something wrong with me. And so some notion now that this might really be a disorder. All that said, fantasy life is totally normal. It's nothing. Don't worry about it. Something bothers you, if you're having weird fantasies, go talk to somebody like a professional, a psychologist. Don't just talk to your friend. Is this normal? Your friend doesn't know. Sexual orientation is another interesting question. It's somewhere between, this is exclusively homosexual. Exclusively. Completely disgusted by the idea of sex with the opposite sex. It's between 3 and 4% of males, it might be a little higher than that, and about 1% of females are exclusively homosexual. Exclusively. It may be a little higher than that, but it's probably not quite as high as I think people think it is. You hear a lot of numbers like 10%. It's probably not 10%. It's probably closer to, if it's going to be anywhere higher than that, maybe 5 and 2. Okay? Now, that being said, a lot of people are not exclusively homosexual or not exclusively heterosexual. They're like mostly one or the other. I think back to a friend of mine, gay friend of mine, and he used to say that having sex with a woman was like eating oatmeal. You'll eat it if you're hungry, but you'd rather have cake. And that's what he thought of guys. And that's whatever. That's cool. But, I mean, he had a girlfriend, and he would have sex with women, but he'd much rather have sex with men.
Are there people who were just sort of null?
Yeah, I mean, there's a suggestion out there that there are people that literally have no attraction to either sex. It seems pretty rare, sort of asexual people. There's people who do that sort of by choice, right? Like celibate people. Celibate, I can't even give it away. But, Groucho Marx, ladies and gentlemen. That's a very small number. That's a very small number. Yep. So there's celibacy by sort of choice or by, nuns and such, profession, right? And then there's celibacy imposed on you because women hate you. it's a joke. Just thinking back to my early 20s. But those people still would probably show, well, they definitely did, show attraction to either the same sex or the opposite sex. Okay? No matter what anybody tells you, you don't choose to be gay or straight. You don't choose your sexual orientation. There's no data suggesting that's true. It is not a lifestyle choice. It is not a lifestyle. It is a thing that happens to you. Let's do a little thought experiment. Let's pretend it's a lifestyle choice. Let's pretend it's like saying, I'm going to buy a dog. Just something you do. Would you choose something like, okay, what I'm going to do is I'm going to choose to be something that is discriminated against by a lot of society, and sometimes I might get beaten up or killed. Seems exceedingly unlikely that's something people go, yeah, I think I'll do that. So that's the first thing, little thought experiment. Secondly, when you ask gay people, and there's been a lot of research on this, when did they know they were gay? They find out they're gay usually when they're about 12, which is when most of us find out we're straight. Right? People don't turn gay. Right? They're like, oh, wait, I'll become gay today. Today, I've decided I will become gay. Right? It just is. It's just one of them things. Also, do you think evolution would have left something like that to chance? It's Seems unlikely. That wouldn't be very adaptive to choose not to reproduce. Right? Also, by the way, there's also homosexuality throughout the animal kingdom. Which is something else that should make you think that, because I doubt penguins, because there are gay, there's a pair of gay penguins in, like, it's at a zoo in New York, I think. A pair of gay penguins.
They do dress very nice.
Yeah, well, they got the tuxes on. Yeah, it's a good look. It's a good look. They're sort of metrosexual penguins, but they're living in New York. And there was a big sort of media storm about this from some nut jobs who got all mad. They're saying these are homosexual penguins. No, animals can't be gay. That's a dumb guy talking there. But they can. Watch these two penguins. So it does happen. And it does happen also, and some people say, oh, that's because it's in a non-natural environment, etc. It happens out in nature, too. It happens out in nature, too. Right? So this should also tell us, again, because animals aren't making those kind of choices. Seems less likely. There's a penguin going, I think I'm going to be a gay penguin. I don't think it happens. It's probably determined in vivo. In other words, it's probably determined, or in utero, rather. It's probably determined by hormone levels, probably. When you're in your mommy's uterus, when you're developing. Actually, makes a great deal of sense to have it work there. Because it's a pretty basic thing about being human, is the sex thing. It's probably, there are data that suggest there are differently organized brains between gay men and straight men. There's not a lot of data on women. Don't know why. There are genetic factors. If your brother's gay, you're more likely to be gay than if your brother wasn't gay. In other words, and then there's the twin studies, same kind of thing. Runs in families.
A rather empirical view on sexuality.
Hell yes. Yes, I do everything empirically. That's my thing. Yes.
But there's worries in the gay community that focusing genetic factors in brain organization does eventually lead to people who will start to look for the gay gene and try to solve
right.
it.
Right.
And is that going to happen?
I think we'll probably know how everything works at some point. So I think we'll know how gay. See, I don't think of it as a gay gene. I think of it as a sexuality. And it's not going to be a single gene anyway. But I think let's pretend it's a single gene. I think we'll call it the sexual orientation gene. Now I'm not gay, so it doesn't. And I'm not in that community. I got a lot of friends that are gay, but I mean, it's not like it's going to directly affect me. I've heard the argument that if we can do that, people are going to abort fetuses that are going to end up being gay. Not to be a concern. But I think with the way society's going, there's a lot more acceptance of it. Right? Still not 100%, which is bizarre.
I suspect that the people who would have a problem with having a gay child would also be the people who would have a problem with aborting a child.
That's interesting. Bill, you're right. I think those two things probably hang together. And I've heard from my gay friends sort of two views. The ones that are sort of that are scientists, they're like, yeah, it'd be cool to know. I just want to know. It'd be neat to know stuff. And then I've heard the other end, which is sort of what you're saying, Jeff, which is like this kind of reticence, right? Like, it's stuff I don't want to know because maybe we end up trying to cure it.
Well, it's a Pandora's box, right?
Yeah.
Once you are allowed to see what makes up a person, you can't really take that away from society.
Nope.
You can't really say, well,
oh, no, you open that, that genie comes out of the bottle, you can't put it back in.
Yeah.
It's like we're never going to not know how to make nuclear weapons anymore. You know, it's just, it's out there now.
Unless we overuse nuclear weapons,
and then we won't know anything.
That's right. Canticle for Leibowitz, a book you should read. The point, it is an interesting question, though, because, I mean, it's sort of a moral question, and science strives to be amoral. Not moral, not immoral. It just is. It's like, here's some facts. Do with them what you will. I think the point scientists have to make here, though, is that to the general public is they're not doing this when they're interested in this because they want to stop the gayness. They're doing this because they just want to know how stuff works. And this is a fundamental thing about a living animal is reproduction. So I think that's why. But yeah, it's a concern. There's no doubt about that. I can see people worrying about it, and I understand the worry. I also think, though, that, like I said, that once this is nailed down a lot more, which is going to take a while. I mean, conservatively 10 years. But, I mean, for us to really understand the whole human genome and how it all works, that's more like 50 years. I think by then, things are seen to be going sort of societally, much more acceptance of people being gay. Right? And like I said, I don't think it's about being gay so much as I think it's something about being, about sexuality in general. But it's a question. There's no doubt. There's no doubt.
I personally think it's probably going to be a huge step forward when the last generation, or a couple generations ago, whatever the last really conservative generation was, once they die off.
Well, and society always changes that way, yeah.
Anytime on Xbox Live, and you'll see exactly how accepting the general public tends to be of homosexuals.
Though I wouldn't call that a very good sample. But... No, you have a point, and I'll tell you something. I also report every one of those people. I find it... There's a difference between what idiots say and what they do, and that's the important thing. Is there still racism? Hell yes. But things are getting better than they were. Ask somebody who's 70 versus someone who's 25. There's more acceptance of things. Differences, just differences in general, diversity in general, right? So, it is an issue. There's no doubt about it. I mean, it's are things getting better? Yeah. Is it better in certain countries than other countries? Yeah. Is it perfect? No. People still get discriminated against. People still get beaten up and killed because of who they want to have sex with. It really, I mean, and I lament things like that. It really bugs me. You just leave each other alone. None of your damn... I don't even understand how people think like that. I really don't.
It's different. Kill it!
Yeah, exactly. I think one of the things... I should go back this slide because it's one other point I want to make. There is a nice... Let's put a positive spin on this, though. If we know that it's something to do with biology, a lot to do with biology, if we know you're built that way, then even if you don't like the gay people... Even if you don't like them, you should not now argue about your kid having a gay football coach or a gay teacher or what, and go on and on. They can't make your kid gay. You can't catch gay. You can't catch straight. So even if you have a real problem with this for reasons that escape me, you're not going to get it. Nobody's going to make you gay. So it's something I think to consider. And I think that's sort of the upside of it, besides just the science that's cool and interesting. If your kid has a gay friend, you shouldn't worry that he's going to become gay. It doesn't rub off on people. Like you can go, oh, it's very, very gay. I'm starting to feel kind of gay now. I have to move away from you. I'm feeling very gay. Right? That's cool. So I think that's the upside of it. It could actually lead to some more acceptance. Like I said, I'm not saying embracing acceptance, but acceptance. So who cares the football coach is gay? Big deal. Doesn't matter. Right? All right. Achievement unlocked. All right, so we've eaten and had sex. What's next? Well, frankly, nothing. No. Nothing really else has any value. Let's talk about something that's, I mean, there's going to be a physiological and biological base for everything, but more of a psychological thing, I guess. Let's refer back to Maslow, and he's talking about what? Well, we got all those physiological basic needs. And then we're going to go further than that. We're going to get into things like trying to become a good person, doing the best you can do at certain things, etc. People that have a high need for achievement, in other words, it matters to them, they actually achieve more. Now you think, wait, that's circular. No, it isn't. If it matters to you to do well at, let's say, school, you will do better at school than someone who doesn't care about it, even if you say your IQs are the same. Okay? So it's actually not circular. At first, it sounds kind of silly. Now, the thing is, you can have a high need for achievement, but if your goals are ridiculous, you're not going to achieve it. Those things, probably because the goals are ridiculous. So if you have to have reasonable and reachable goals, if you got all C's in the first term, it's not a reasonable goal to say, I'm going to get all A's this term. It just probably isn't a reasonable goal. If you got all C's last term, it's not even reachable to say you're going to have an A average at the end of the year. Do the math. It can't be done. Well, I'll become an A student, have an A average by the end of my university career. That would be reachable if you have the skills. Right? So you want reasonable and reachable goals. So it's not just one or the other. It's got to be both. High achievement motivations often linked to parental behavior. So if your parents, and I don't mean pushy parents. This isn't what I'm talking about here. I'm not talking about hockey parents. You know, like when you ever go to a kid's hockey game and you see some of those parents, they're like a 9-year-old kid and they're screaming at him at his intensity level. He's nine! He's having fun. Right? I'm talking about people whose parents set reasonable and reachable goals. Because, I mean, when you're young, your parents are setting your goals pretty much, not you. Sometimes it's you. Sometimes it's things like, well, today I'm going to finish this whole math sheet. But, I mean, beyond that, I'm going to build an X-Wing fighter out of Lego. That's my little kid. It's not very good. But for the most part, it's like your folks saying, you know, you do this, you do that. Make them reasonable goals and reachable goals. So think about sports, right? I played hockey as a kid. I never once remember my dad saying, you will lead the league in scoring. Because dad thought to himself, I'm pretty sure, Dave can't see that well. But I remember my father used to always say to me, I just play defense, he'd say, don't be out of position. Never be the reason a goal was scored. Don't be out of position. And I was pretty good about that. That was okay. He also used to say great things like, you know, take the man and the puck will take care of itself. They didn't have, when I played, you didn't have, you can't body check till you're 10 or 11. It was awesome. And I was a big boy. I was a big boy. We also didn't wear face shields. We wore helmets. I'm not that old. But that was the kind of thing he would set. I remember my dad saying that. Right? I think I have a pretty good achievement motivation. You know, reasonable enough. But like my parents always knew what I couldn't do too. So they knew an unreachable goal wasn't something. My dad never said, why don't you learn how to drive? Come on, give it a try. No, I can't pass the eye test. Right? It's sort of like knowing when to stop pushing. Like, it's, you know, you can't. There's certain things you can't do. And you should know those things about yourself. I try to be like that with my kids, too. There's two kinds of motivation we can talk about here, intrinsic and extrinsic. Intrinsic is motivation that comes from yourself. Extrinsic is that comes from outside you. So if you think about it, the intrinsic motivation for this class, for you, is to do is, you might think, well, I want to get this grade. The extrinsic motivation is, I want to do better than my friends. You know, I want to impress a professor. I don't know why you'd want to impress me. Who the hell am I? I want to impress my parents. That's extrinsic. Intrinsic, and you want to, at some point when you're a little kid, eventually you sort of internalize that external stuff your parents do. Right? Intrinsic motivation works much better than extrinsic. Right? I'm not doing this for anybody but myself. One of the things I always say to students when they come by my office and like for academic counseling, maybe, and they're a little bit concerned about their grades, and they say things like, well, you know, what are my parents going to think? And I usually look at them and say, are you going to school for your parents or yourself? And if they say for my parents, I say, you probably shouldn't be going to school then. You should go get a job somewhere. This isn't for your parents. You do this to make yourself a better person. If you can change around and think like that, your grades actually get better. Right? Because then you're letting yourself down if you don't work hard, you don't do as best you can do. Of course, we have to motivate people. Sometimes it has to be external. Right? Sometimes you lead a group, you have a team, whatever. So how do you motivate people to achieve stuff, you know? Yeah, stuff, that's all I got. Well, the first thing you have to do is cultivate that intrinsic motivation. So again, as I said, when I talk to students, I try to be a motivational speaker that lives down by the river, but Chris Farley, anybody? But I want you to do well, and I want, because I, to be completely frank, I hate when people do poorly because it makes me sad. Unless they aren't trying, then I think it's kind of funny. I do. If people aren't trying and they're jerks, then I think it's kind of funny. But people that, the worst thing is people that try hard and don't get it. That's sad. And I hate that. And a lot of times I've found over my career that it's that fear of what are my parents going to think? What are my friends going to think? And I, you know, are your friends taking these classes? Are your parents taking the classes? Well, they're paying for it. My parents, it's like, well, I know. Tell them, however, that they're paying for only about 30% of it, the rest being paid for by the taxpayers of the country. Yes. So feel bad about the whole country, not just your parents. But I tell people all the time, do this for yourself. You do this for yourself. Many of you guys, you'll find as you go a little further on, you'll switch your major. And a lot of times you'll switch your major because it's like, I like this better. It's more interesting to me, whatever this is. And people end up doing better. So the first thing you got to do is cultivate that, is try to get people to be intrinsically motivated. So you don't say, if you're like a boss, you don't say, why should you do this? Because I'm the boss and I said so. You got to keep people curious. Not curious so much that you're saying, no, I'm not going to tell you why. Let them discover things on their own. A great example of this is Google. Google's a really weird company. Besides the fact that they pretty much are now a non-state nation and are at war with China, which eventually leads to corporations being like countries, and then that leads eventually to the 1975 film Rollerball with James Caan. Not the bad remake in 2002. But what does Google do? 20% of time, people that work for Google are allowed to do whatever the hell they want. Work on their own projects. That's where things like Gmail come from. Oh, I want to do this just for the hell of it. That's cool. They avoid heavy reliance, people that know how to do this, on extrinsic motivation. Now, yeah, you got to pay people. You got to pay people. But getting a paycheck isn't the only reason I go to work. Getting grades, I hope, isn't the only reason you're going to school. Right? You set those goals for yourself, intrinsic motivation, you do stuff. Tell people why they're doing things rather than just telling them to do things. If you can, you can't tell people everything, especially if you're the head of some big department or something. You can't just tell everyone why all the time. But it's better, as far as achievement goes, to inform people than to just control them. Attend to people's motives. So ask them why they're doing something. Why are you doing it this way? Not in a judgmental way. Why are you doing it this way, son? No, you're doing it like, you have an interesting approach here. Why are you doing it that way rather than this way? And again, set reasonable but challenging goals. You've got to be challenging enough people stay curious, right? They still keep trying. Now, I realize when you look at this that there are certain occasions where you can't do this. In the military, and someone says, you got to take that hill. You can't say, okay, guys, now, I know you want to do this all for your own reasons. You say, you go there. That's what you do, right? So it's different in that kind of situation. But typically, you can just see this. This is going to be a much more pleasant work environment, right? And if you think about good companies, good places to work, they do these things. Questions about that? All right. I think we should stop now because I don't want to teach you new stuff that'll interfere. Remember interference last term. I don't want to interfere with anything new, anything old, rather. You have a test on Wednesday. I will see you guys later. Yeah.
There's a small town in the mountains. Where the streets are wide and still, there are children making angels in the snow. The sunset paints the sky at night, an old man works by candlelight. A tiny baby smiles and waves hello. In the cold gray light of dawn, an eagle flies, and the men are happy wearing matching ties. A pair of poodles, a broken finger will not bend. Soup with noodles, female Klingon's drunk boyfriend. A sexy lady, this party's better than it seems. Warren Beatty, dear sleeping giant panda, pleasant dreams. A place to get some pie. A rainbow floats above a waterfall. A Ferris wheel, a carousel. The landlord never learned to spell. Someone put graffiti on the wall. Atop the Christmas tree, a shining star. Wires rocking out on air guitar. A freight train passes. Someone's grandma owns a gun. A dog with glasses. A strange balloon man has too much fun. Thumbs up for Slurpees. If you're receiving and you're not gay, a case of herpes. As it turns out, the iPad is A-OK.
This podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.